From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, demonstrations in eastern Ukraine, 20 years since the Rwandan genocide that took 800,000 lives. The UN says civilians and the CAR were fired upon, plus a warning on this World Health Day. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Crowds of pro-Russia protesters stormed government buildings in the eastern Ukraine Sunday, waving Russian flags and calling for regional referendums on independence. In Luhansk, near the Russian border, hundreds of people surrounded the local headquarters of the security service and clashed with police. Eastern Ukraine was the heartland of support for former President Viktor Yanukovych, who fled to Russia in February after months of protest. This Russian-speaking woman referred to NATO's embrace of the interim Ukrainian government. She asked who would prefer NATO over going home to Russia to be with family. About half of eastern Ukraine's residents are ethnic Russians, many of whom believe Ukraine's acting authorities are Ukrainian nationalists who would oppress Russians. Ukraine's interim authorities deny they are infringing the rights of ethnic Russian population and accuse Moscow of trying to cause instability. Veterans of World War II in Ukraine have expressed some shock at Russia's military actions in Ukraine and their seizure of Crimea. The former Soviet allies in October will jointly celebrate 70 years since the end of the war, but some veterans here, there, in Kiev are now reluctant to take part. VOA's Daniel Scherf reporting from Kiev.
World War II veterans of Kiev's Holosievsky district never imagined Ukraine would be a target of Russian aggression. Veterans organization council head Sergei Korokov says they are still stunned at their former Soviet allies' annexation of Crimea. And under Moscow's continued military threats, their plans to join Russia in marking the end of the so-called war against fascism are being questioned.
That is why all veterans are now worrying how we are going to celebrate and get ready for this date. Because on the border of our dear and beloved Ukraine are brothers, Russian soldiers. There are tanks, armored vehicles, and in my consciousness, in my mind, I cannot imagine how this could have happened.
World War II Navy veteran Dmitry Prohorov fought with the Soviets to defend Crimea, losing his arm in battle. He says Russia's taking back the Black Sea Peninsula by force is absurd.
This question should have been negotiated at a round table and decided for both countries, Russia and Ukraine. Both should own Crimea and work together to develop the territory in the Black Sea Navy. This would have been smarter.
Like many of Ukraine's veterans, Korokov has a Russian wife and says the two countries' destinies are interlaced.
I love our nation and do not want a feud. Even more, I do not want war. War should not happen between our countries. Let our politicians find an agreement and we will support them.
Infantry veteran Georgi Kireyev fought in the Battle of Stalingrad, where more than a million died. He was shot 8 times and twice mistakenly pronounced dead.
Russia, Belarus, Ukraine are Slavic nations. It's one nation. They should live in friendship and happiness. I hope that with time this will happen. Maybe, taking into consideration our age, maybe we will not be alive at that time. Maybe our grandchildren will unite again with Russia.
Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Kiev.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
Rwanda's foreign minister has reasserted claims France had a role in the 1994 Rwandan genocide and French diplomats pulled out of genocide memorial events in response to the accusations. VOA's Gabe Joslow has our report.
At an international forum on genocide held Sunday in Kigali, Foreign Minister Louise Mushikiwabo stood by Rwandan President Paul Kagame's remarks, implying the French government played a direct role in the preparation and execution of the genocide.
That official France in the early 90s, all the way to the time of the genocide, wronged this country is a fact.
Mr. Kagame's remarks to the African news weekly Jeune Afrique prompted France to withdraw a delegation due to attend genocide memorial events this week in Kigali. French Foreign Affairs spokesman Romain Nadal told VOA his government was surprised by Mr. Kagame's declarations, saying they go against the ongoing process of reconciliation between the two countries. Relations between France and Rwanda deteriorated after the genocide due to accusations that France had supported ethnic Hutu militias responsible for killing nearly 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus in a span of 100 days. While France has denied any role in the slaughter, Mushikiwabo said relations cannot be repaired if Rwanda has to accept the French version of events.
It will become impossible for our two countries to move forward if the condition is that Rwanda has to forgo its history in order to get along with France.
Kigali will host officials from across the world this week for ceremonies commemorating the 20th anniversary of the genocide. In an opinion article timed for the anniversary, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon urged the international community to learn from its failure to stop the genocide in Rwanda and to take stronger action to confront modern-day crises like the conflict in the Central African Republic. The international community, he said, cannot claim to care about atrocity crimes and then shrink from the commitment of resources and will required to actually prevent them. At a ceremony in Kigali Monday, Rwanda's President Kagame will light a national flame of mourning that will burn for 100 days. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Kigali.
And UN Secretary General Ban was in the Central African Republic on Sunday before going to Kigali, where he said the international community must do more and act more quickly. Intercommunal violence in the country has killed more than 2,000 people since December and displaced an additional 800,000. VOA's And Look was with the UN chief in Bangui during his visit.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon told the CAR's acting parliament, the National Transition Council, that their country is in, quote, a state of anarchy.
La communauté internationale a fait défaut au Rwanda il y a 20 ans. Et nous risquons...
Mr. Ban said the international community failed the people of Rwanda 20 years ago and is at risk of not doing enough for the people of the CAR today. The UN leader noted that atrocious crimes are being committed in the CAR, including lynchings, decapitations, and sexual violence. He told the council that ethno-religious cleansing is a reality, and that Muslims and Christians have been placed in mortal danger simply because of who they are or what they believe. The Secretary General commended the efforts of French and African Union troops here, but said they are, quote, under-resourced and overwhelmed by what he called the sheer scale of the need. Mr. Ban said he continues to push for transforming the AU troops here into a UN peacekeeping force that would include 10,000 soldiers and about 2,000 police. During his whirlwind visit to Bangui, the Secretary General greeted displaced persons outside the camp at the airport. It's a staggering makeshift patchwork of shelters, home to about 60,000 people. Many have been there since December 5th, when heavy fighting and intercommunal killing broke out in the capital. A representative of the displaced persons at the camp told the Secretary General they are not there waiting for handouts. He says they want to go home, but many homes were looted or destroyed, and their neighborhoods are not safe. He said disarmament is the solution. The Secretary General also visited the central mosque in the PK5 neighborhood, where approximately 10,000 Muslim civilians remain trapped. Anti-Balaka militia outside are a daily threat, despite international troops on the perimeter. at the mosque, they held up signs saying they want to be evacuated. There were several signs calling for the division of the country, a growing concern here as the Muslim minority flees to relative safety in the northeast, a zone still under the control of the mostly Muslim Exelica rebels. An imam at the mosque read the Secretary General a dark inventory of what they have suffered since December. The murders, the threats, the destruction of their homes, businesses, and mosques. Ban Ki-moon spoke to the Muslims of Bangui. He says he is, quote, saddened by what he has seen. Your life, he says, is very difficult and very dangerous. Human rights, he said, is top priority, and he has deployed UN investigators to the CAR. Mr. Ban had the same message here as at every stop. You can count on me, he said. The international community will not fail you. The UN Security Council could vote on establishing a UN peacekeeping force for the CAR in a matter of days, and Mr. Ban said he is pushing for, quote, decisive action. However, analysts say a UN force would likely not be able to deploy until at least September. And look, VOA News, Bangui.
An investigation by the UN Human Rights Monitors has found that on March 29th, Chadian soldiers fired on civilians in the Central African Republic's capital, killing and wounding dozens. UN Human Rights spokesperson Rupert Colville said several sources have told the investigating team the Chadian force had entered CAR's capital, Bangui, to extract remaining Chadians and other Muslim inhabitants. He said the soldiers apparently were trying to save these people from attacks by Christian anti-Balaka militia.
As soon as a convoy of the Chadian National Army reached the PK-12 market area around 3 p.m., it allegedly opened fire on the population without any provocation. As people fled in all directions in panic, the soldiers continued to fire indiscriminately. At the time of the shooting, the market was full of people, including many young girls and women buying and selling produce.
Colville told VOA the Chadian soldiers were not part of MISCA, the African Union-led peacekeeping force in the Central African Republic. He said they were part of Chad's regular national army.
There have been Chadian soldiers earlier as well as now operating inside CAR. In many cases, they've saved lives. They've evacuated both the people of Chadian nationality and also other Muslims out to Chad. And I think we should note that in many cases, they will have saved lives by doing that.
Chad has announced it plans to withdraw around 850 of its troops from MISCA, citing an alleged malicious campaign targeting its soldiers. Chad's withdrawal is seen as a major blow to the UN efforts to deploy a force of 10,000 soldiers in the CAR to end the sectarian violence in the country.
VOA Special English, a way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com. For 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
A British Navy ship with sophisticated sound locating equipment arrived today in an area of the southern Indian Ocean to determine whether underwater sounds picked up by a Chinese ship came from the missing Malaysian Airlines data recorders. Meantime, the Australian Navy ship, which is carrying high-tech sound detectors from the U.S. Navy, is investigating a sound it picked up in another area about 555 kilometers away. Searchers are anticipating good weather today with 9 military planes, 3 civilian planes, and a total of 14 ships expected to search for Flight 370, which vanished nearly a month ago on a flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing with 239 people aboard. Also in the news, Afghanistan's presidential vote is being hailed a success with 7 million voters braving Taliban threats to go to the polls. But as VOA's Sharon Bain reports now from Kabul, Afghans say the true success of the election lies with the candidates accepting the results.
For one rare weekend, Afghans like Ismail Qureshi were happy. Standing outside Gold's Gym in central Kabul, Qureshi says the weekend presidential elections were a huge success.
He
says, this is a happy moment for Afghans. We have voted for a new leader. 95% of the people are happy that things were quiet and they cast their votes. It's good for our people, he says. About 7 million voters braved Taliban death threats to cast their ballots for a new president Saturday. U.S. President Barack Obama commended the Afghan people on Saturday's voter turnout for an election he described as critical to securing Afghanistan's democratic future as well as continued international support. The vote, says Andrew Wilder of the United States Institute of Peace, was a decisive message to the militants.
If 7 million Afghans turned out to vote, despite all these threats, I think there's only one way to interpret that as a real significant defeat for the Taliban.
But while the voting is over, the election process is not. Allegations of fraud have begun to come in, and the Taliban on Sunday attacked a convoy carrying boxes full of ballots to be counted. The election workers were killed and the boxes destroyed. Wilder, who was in Afghanistan for the vote, says officials need to thoroughly investigate all claims of fraud or the election will risk losing credibility in the eyes of the people.
There are areas where there probably was significant levels of fraud, and I think that needs to be investigated. But I personally, at this point, given the turnout figures, would be surprised if the fraud was at such a decisive level that it would have a major impact on the outcome.
If successful, Saturday's election will be Afghanistan's first democratic transfer of power from one elected leader to another. On the streets of Kabul, Abdul Habib says it's time his voice and that of all Afghans is heard. He says the candidates have to respect the vote of the people. The people voted despite very hard conditions. They came out and cast their ballots, and the candidates should respect the verdict of the people. The worry for now is that if the candidates start to squabble over who won, their fight could spill onto the streets, erasing Saturday's voting success. Sharon Bain, VOA News, Kabul.
Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orbán declared victory in elections on Sunday, saying the vote showed that Hungary was the most united nation in Europe. Orbán said the results was a confirmation of his government's policies to create jobs, support families, and fight for national sovereignty.
Tisztelt Hölgyeim és Uraim! Kellő alázattal és méltósággal, ahogy illik hozzánk.
He said, with due humility and dignity that suits us, we can say that all doubts and uncertainties have disappeared. We won. Election officials said Orbán's Fidesz party and its small ally, the Christian Democratic People's Party, look set to win close to two-thirds of the parliamentary seats. Turning now to the Middle East peace process, where Israel's chief negotiator in peace negotiations with the Palestinians says the talks are in crisis. Tzipi Livni's comments came over the weekend, one day after U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said the Obama administration is reevaluating its role in the talks following moves by Israel and the Palestinians that have caused the U.S. brokered talks to collapse. Mr. Kerry said Friday there is a limit to the amount of time and effort the U.S. can invest in both sides if they're unwilling to take constructive steps for peace.
Regrettably, in the last few days, both sides have taken steps that are not helpful, and that's evident to everybody. So we are going to evaluate very carefully exactly where this is and where it might possibly be able to go.
The peace talks have veered off course with Israel to not release a fourth group of Palestinian prisoners on time. Palestinian leadership responded by signing application letters to a number of international conventions seen as a move to gain statehood. Palestinians had promised not to attempt to do that during the talks. Israel responded by canceling the prisoner release altogether. At least 29 Syrian rebels were killed Sunday when a car bomb exploded in the central city of Homs. Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said the death toll could increase. There was no immediate explanation for the explosion. Earlier, in a separate incident, the state news agency said a mortar fired by rebels struck the Damascus Opera House killing two. Libya's government has reached an agreement with rebels to reopen two of four oil ports and a major breakthrough to end an eight-month blockade. Full details of the deal were not immediately known, but the reopening of the two ports will boost last week's weak government, which is struggling to control the countries nearly 3 years after the uprising ousted veteran leader Muammar Gaddafi. The blockade has cost the government billions of dollars and lost oil revenues. UN and international agencies are warning more than half the world's population is at risk from the growing threat of vector-borne diseases. In advance of World Health Day, which is today, April 7th, the agencies urge nations to act to contain these often fatal, debilitating diseases. Lisa Schlein is in Geneva with our report.
One bite of a mosquito, a sandfly, a black fly, or a tick can be more than annoying. It can be fatal. Every year, the World Health Organization reports more than 1 billion people are infected and more than 1 million die from vector-borne diseases such as malaria, dengue, Lyme disease, and yellow fever. The WHO is focusing on the threat posed by dengue, which it says is the most rapidly spreading vector-borne disease in the world. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies also is campaigning to get governments to address what it calls the silent disaster. Red Cross Senior Emergency Health Officer Amanda McClelland says dengue is a neglected disease which mainly affects the poorest, most vulnerable members of society.
We've seen the expansion of dengue from 15,000 cases in 1960 to over 380, 390 million possible cases right now. Families that are already close to the poverty line, families that are already affected by heavy disease burdens, can't afford to get this disease, and they can't afford for multiple people in their families to get this disease. And this is why the Red Cross is focusing specifically on dengue for the next 12 months and beyond.
The World Health Organization says during the past 50 years, the disease has spread to more than 100 countries, putting more than 2.5 billion people at risk. About 75% of those at risk are found in the Asia-Pacific region. But WHO Vector Ecology and Neglected Tropical Diseases Department Director Raman Velayudhan notes even developed countries, such as those in Europe, Australia, and the United States, are at risk from this vector-borne disease. Dr. Velayudhan tells VOA the spread of dengue is caused by environmental changes and increased international travel. He says the free movement of people and goods in Europe and elsewhere also enables the free movement of mosquitoes and other vectors.
In terms of climate change, essentially, we do not have strong scientific basis yet to establish that, but having said that, theoretically, any increase in temperature helps multiplication of mosquitoes and the virus within the body of the mosquito. So, for example, a mosquito life cycle may take 20 days when the temperature is 15 degrees, but when the temperature reaches 25 degrees, it will hatch in 7 days.
Dengue is a severe flu-like illness with no vaccine or cure. But the WHO and the Red Cross say the disease can be managed and prevented by using insecticide-treated mosquito nets, improved sanitation, and the reduction of mosquito breeding sites. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And a sad note now, numerous media are reporting that Mickey Rooney, who spent nearly his entire life in show business, died on Sunday. He was 93. All indications are he died of natural causes. He was one of the most famous child actors in entertainment history. He played the role of Andy Hardy in 20 Hardy Boy films. He was in numerous other films. He was the first teenager ever to be nominated for an Oscar. That happened for the movie Striking Up the Band in the 1940s. Continued to act even until recently. He was in the Muppets movie in 2011. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. A reminder, the top world news is coming your way. I hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Daryl Smith, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Monday.
This is Today in History. On April 7th, 451, Attila the Hun sacked the town of Metz, a city now located in France, as well as other cities in ancient Gaul. The Huns were a nomadic people who dominated parts of Eastern Europe, the Caucasus, and Central Asia in the 4th and 5th century. In 1767, one of a series of conflicts between Siam and Burma ended following a brutal Burmese siege of the Siamese capital. The Burmese gains were lost a few years later when China invaded the area. A new Siamese dynasty emerged when the nation was restored in 1770 under a dynasty connected to the current Thai monarch. Hard feelings still exist between the modern nations of Burma and Thailand stemming from the conflict. In 1927, the first long-distance public television broadcast took place. A photo of Commerce Secretary Herbert Hoover was broadcast from Washington, D.C. to New York City. In 1953, IBM unveiled the first commercially available scientific computer. In all, 19 units were manufactured, most of them for U.S. national laboratories, the U.S. Weather Bureau, and aircraft manufacturers. In 1954, President Dwight D. Eisenhower first spoke of what he called the falling domino theory, a concept that became the justification behind U.S. involvement in Vietnam. His metaphor suggested that if Indonesia fell to communism, all of Southeast Asia and Australia would be threatened. On this day in 2003, U.S. troops captured Baghdad in the Second Persian Gulf War. Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein's regime fell 2 days later. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United Nations Human Rights Council has extended the mandate for the special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in Iran. The March 28th vote on the resolution saw 21 countries vote in favor, 9 vote against, and 16 abstain. The resolution expressed serious concern at the developments noted in the report that Special Rapporteur Ahmad Shahid submitted to the Council earlier in March and urged the government of Iran to start cooperating fully with Mr. Shahid. The United States welcomes the resolution by the Council, which shows that human rights abuses suffered by the Iranian people at the hands of their government are a matter deserving the focused attention of the international community. As the Special Rapporteur's March 13th report indicates, while there has been some welcome change in rhetoric from the Iranian government, there has been no significant improvement in Iran's overall human rights situation. There has been an increase in executions in Iran, with courts issuing death sentences after trials that do not meet basic standards of due process. The arrest and detention of individuals for the peaceful exercise of fundamental rights, including the right to expression, association, or belief, continue. Authorities subject members of religious and ethnic minorities to ongoing persecution. As of the 14th of January 2014, wrote Mr. Shahid, at least 895 prisoners of conscience and political prisoners were reportedly imprisoned. This number includes 379 political activists, 292 religious practitioners, 92 human rights defenders, including 50 ethnic rights activists, 71 civic activists, 37 journalists and netizens, and 24 student activists. As U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for International Organization Affairs Paula Schrieffer said in Geneva, support for the renewal of the Special Rapporteur's mandate sends a strong signal of international unity to the Iranian government on the need for Iran to address a continuing pattern of human rights abuses. We hope, she said, it will also encourage the Iranian government to cooperate with the international community to uphold the rights and freedoms of the Iranian people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.